This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The state of Massachusetts allows same-sex couples to marry. So what happens when a same-sex couple married in Massachusetts moves to one of the many states where marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman? That's the question we'll take up in this portion of the program. Our guest this afternoon is Northwestern Law Professor Andrew Koppelman. He is the author of Same-Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. In his book, Professor Koppelman does not make an argument for or against same-sex marriage. He acknowledges the issue of same-sex marriage divides us, but he says there are existing rules that can help us find a way across this very thorny landscape. Listener, your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call this afternoon. Join the discussion. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Same-Sex, Different States, Andrew Koppelman is the author of The Gay Rights Question in Contemporary American Law and Anti-Discrimination Law and Social Equity. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Koppelman, welcome.
It's very good to be here.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Well, Massachusetts allows same-sex marriage. Other states allow civil unions or have domestic partnership laws. But many of the states say marriage is defined as a union between one man and one woman. So at this point in time, how are the states dealing with the differences?
Well, there's very little law yet. In order for us to find out how a state's going to deal with one of these issues, there has to be some suit filed in court, and the suit has to make it through the court to a decision, and then ultimately it has to go up to the state Supreme Court for a final pronouncement about what that state's law is, and it can take years. So there are a few decisions by a couple of states addressing the question at the margin, but a lot of these questions are unanswered. You really have to go to earlier law that dealt with analogous cases in order to get a sense of what the law ought to be in this area.
Yeah, and you argue that in large part what we could do here is take a look at precedents that we have from our history involving interracial marriage. Why is that appropriate?
Well, we're in a situation we haven't faced in a while, because right now, until the same-sex marriage issue came up, the country wasn't really deeply divided about who could marry whom. So you didn't get a marriage in one state violating the strong public policy of another state. But it wasn't always thus. The states used to be very much divided about which marriages could be allowed. It used to be that in some states, people could marry at the age of 12, and there were other states that didn't allow that. There were issues about what constituted incest. Was it the case that marriage of cousins was incest? Some states said yes, some states said no. They used to be quite divided about whether people could remarry after being named as the guilty party in a divorce. But the biggest divide was interracial marriage, and that's where you get, I think, the most apropos law, where some states have a really strong moral objection to marriages that other states don't see anything at all wrong with, and sometimes you've got questions where more than one state's law arguably applies. And they worked out solutions to those problems, and some of those solutions are relevant today.
Yeah. Tell us the story of Sarah Spake and Pink Ross.
Aha. Okay. So the Spake and Ross. This was in 1873. Sarah Spake left her home in North Carolina, and she went into South Carolina, and she married Pink Ross. Sarah was white. Pink was black. At the time, this was during Reconstruction, North Carolina had a law against interracial marriage. South Carolina didn't. Northern troops were still occupying the South in the wake of the Civil War, and at that time, supporters of white supremacy were in retreat in South Carolina. Well, after a couple of months, they decided to move to North Carolina, and 3 years later, they were arrested, and they said, hey, we're married, and the state responded that their marriage was void in North Carolina. And in the end, the North Carolina courts upheld the marriage. They said, you've got to have the same law throughout the United States. And they had the North Carolina court said, look, they had a right to get married where they were married, and they had a right to come here. And so even though we object to this marriage, we've got to recognize them as married, because otherwise, it would be ridiculous to have, just reading from the opinion, upon this question above all others, it's desirable that there should not be one law in Maine and another in Texas.
Yeah. Even though this was clearly distasteful to these judges.
Oh, yeah. They said that they said that marriages were, I think the word they used was revolting. But they said, you know, you've got to have the same law about whether somebody's married or not married. Mm. And they said, you're not trying to evade our law if you get married in a state where you had a right to live.
Yeah. Now, the way that the North Carolina courts dealt with this case, was that typical of the way courts dealt with this kind of issue or atypical?
Well, first you've got to figure out what the issue is. And the issues, the way that the courts dealt with this then, and I think that this is probably the most important thing to keep in mind now, is the basic principle was that each state had a right to govern who its own citizens could marry. So you have this result in this case where they lived in the state where they lived in South Carolina. They were living there when they got married. They kept on living in South Carolina. It would have been very different if you got lots of cases where a couple from the South went to a state that allowed interracial marriage, got married, and came right back home again. So there they were just trying to avoid the restrictions of their home state's laws. In those cases, the courts almost always said that the state where you live gets to govern who you can marry, and you don't get to get out of that just by going for a day across a border and coming back again. So the real question is, were these people playing games to try to evade their home state's laws? Now, that already disposes of what I think is the biggest worry of opponents of same-sex marriage, who think that either you're going to have a blanket rule of non-recognition that says that same-sex marriages aren't going to have any effect at all in, let's say, Illinois, or else people from Illinois are going to go to Massachusetts, actually, given where we are, more likely Canada, it's closer. They'll go to Canada, they'll get married, they'll come right back here, and we'll have to recognize the marriages. If you say that Illinois gets to govern who its own residents can marry, then that can't happen. But if you say that the rule is a blanket rule of non-recognition, that we, you know, here in Illinois, we're not going to recognize any same-sex marriage for any purpose. Well, does that mean that somebody who's married in Massachusetts can safely run away to Chicago with the family's assets? Mm-hmm. The family can't come after him? It'd be crazy.
Yeah.
Or if somebody from Massachusetts is hospitalized here and the hospital needs to know who's entitled to make the patient's medical decisions.
Yeah.
And can somebody in Massachusetts who's married to somebody in Massachusetts come to Illinois and marry somebody else of the opposite sex so that they have a spouse in each state? You've got to recognize the marriages for some purposes. If you don't do that, you get these crazy results.
Yeah. I have wondered, to what extent might contracts, wills, and powers of attorney, legal instruments, be used by same-sex couples to protect their interests? And you look at that in the very first chapter of your book, and there are shortcomings. Would you talk about that?
Well, I think the biggest shortcoming, it actually is possible to duplicate some of the benefits of marriage by wills and powers of attorney. And if you are willing to go and hire a lawyer and spend $5,000, the lawyer can go through all of this try and work it all out for you. But there are an awful lot of people who don't have $5,000. Yeah. And one of the benefits of having this off-the-shelf institution called marriage is that it means people who aren't rich can get these benefits. But there are some benefits that make obvious sense. If I die, my wife will inherit my house without having estate taxes imposed on it, without there being a transfer tax. The bank does not get to foreclose on the house because the owner has died. My wife is entitled to my Social Security benefits. My wife is entitled to inherit my 401k. There are all of these benefits to marriage that you can't create by powers of attorney and wills. You can't create a legal document that gets you out of having to pay a tax, for instance.
Yeah. And near the end of the book, you quote a woman who writes about her own same-sex partnership. The documents that she and her partner signed allow her to care for her if she's in a coma, but so long as she's conscious, no nurse or physician has any obligation to tell me anything about her condition or care.
That's right. That's E.J. Graff. You can't do a power of attorney of that kind once a person's conscious. There's a whole range of rights and responsibilities that are hard to duplicate by legal documents. So part of this is an individual rights question, but part of it is a federalism question. If Massachusetts is going to create certain rights and responsibilities for their own citizens, will those rights and responsibilities continue in existence when people cross state lines just to travel? I mean, if somebody is driving through Illinois on the interstate, had no intention of staying in Illinois, mm-hmm. is passing through Illinois just because Illinois is in the way as they're trying to get to Wisconsin, and they get into a car accident and they're hospitalized, it doesn't make sense for them to be ambushed by Illinois law. It's not just that doesn't show enough respect for the couples. That doesn't show enough respect for Massachusetts' right to govern itself.
Mm. One of the things you write about it is something called choice of law. What is it?
The general problem, same-sex marriage is only one instance of it. Choice of law is the area of law, the set of rules in law that govern what you do in a case where it's not clear which jurisdiction's laws apply. So if a problem involves the laws of more than one jurisdiction, let's imagine that I'm in Illinois, and I make a contract with somebody in New Jersey. And I write the contract, and I fax it to the person in New Jersey, and they sign it, and they fax it back to me, and I sign it, and I fax it back to them. And we did this all over the phone. Well, which state's laws apply? Is it Illinois law? Is it New Jersey law? And you get lots of cases where it's just not clear which state's laws apply in a given case. And there's a whole set of legal rules, treatises have been written on the question of, in these cases where you've got more than one jurisdiction's laws that might apply, how do you decide?
Mm-hmm.
And the approach that really dominates and has for more than half a century now is you try to figure out what the policies are of the different states and which state has a stronger legitimate interest in having its law apply.
But public policy, talk about that. How does that's such an amorphous kind of concept.
Well, the general rule, there's what's most relevant to the same-sex marriage issue is that the general rule with marriages has been that a marriage, if it's valid where it's celebrated, it's valid everywhere unless it violates the strong public policy of the state where the parties make their home. So here's an example of what I think is, I think no one would doubt is a legitimate use of public policy in marriage law. This is another story in the book. It's 1956. Shirley wants to marry Stephen, but Shirley is 16 years old. And under New Jersey law at the time, she can't get married without her parents' permission, and her parents are less enthusiastic about Stephen than she is. So they solve the problem by traveling to Indiana, where the law is less restrictive. They get married there. They come back to New Jersey. They move in together. A year later, Stephen is in prison on several counts of automobile theft, and Shirley regrets having gotten into this marriage. And so now she wants to get out of the marriage. It's extremely difficult to get a divorce in New Jersey in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
Probably impossible for Shirley. There's no adultery. There's no desertion. So she wants to be able to argue there never was a marriage in the first place. And here you've got a choice of law problem. Which state's law applies? Is it New Jersey or is it Indiana? And the New Jersey courts ended up holding, Indiana has no interest in this marriage.
Mm-hmm.
This couple was in Indiana for a couple of hours. Indiana is not going to experience the consequences of applying Indiana law. The consequences of applying the law are only going to be experienced in New Jersey by people in New Jersey. That's why New Jersey has the stronger interest in having its law apply. And when New Jersey put this age restriction on marriage, it was precisely for the purpose of protecting young people from this kind of foolish decision.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to apply New Jersey law here, and that's what the New Jersey court did.
You mentioned divorce in New Jersey in the 1950s. In our history, there was a time when couples went to Nevada or they went out of the country to get divorced because it was simpler to dissolve a marriage there than in other states. Did states where divorce was more difficult to attain recognize the divorce granted?
There they had to, and the reason is, this is another choice of law rule, when a court has made a decision after litigation in a proceeding between adversaries, John versus Mary, once a court hands down a decision, that decision has to be good all over the United States. So if I owe you money and I don't pay it and you sue me and the court says that I have to pay you the money, I don't get out of having to pay you the money by going to another state. If I go to another state, the other state has to enforce it. And what the Supreme Court said with divorce was, divorce is like that too. The decision to have the divorce is a judgment as between John and Mary if they're married. So if the Nevada court says that John and Mary are divorced, that's a judgment of a court that has to be enforced everywhere in the United States. There's a provision of the U.S. Constitution called the Full Faith and Credit Clause that says that states have to give full faith and credit to the decisions of other states, and the Supreme Court has understood that to mean you've got to give effect to the judgments, the final decisions rendered by courts after litigation.
Mm-hmm.
That applies to divorce, but it doesn't apply to marriage. There's been a lot of confusion about this. Marriages are not the result of adversarial litigation, not in the case
that
I'm aware of.
No.
So full faith and credit is actually irrelevant to the question of whether
states
have to recognize same-sex marriages.
Yeah. Andrew Koppelman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Same-Sex Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the telephone numbers, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. How was the issue of polygamy dealt with in our history?
Polygamy actually has hardly ever come up in American courts. And, of course, there was polygamy for a long time in Utah under the Mormons in the early period of the Mormons. But it's very odd. I was actually surprised to find this out, that even when the Mormons were in complete control of Utah, they never passed a law saying that there would be legal recognition of the polygamous marriages. They just didn't feel the need to have the state recognize their unions. They just didn't have a high opinion of the state. And so from the time they first arrived in Utah, and Utah wasn't part of the United States at the beginning, the governing law was always either Mexican law or the common law of Great Britain, which America adopted, and neither of them recognized polygamous marriages. So you never had legal recognition of these marriages. There was a system of ecclesiastical courts that the Mormon Church had, which adjudicated disputes, but they didn't issue decisions that the state would enforce. So you never got any conflict of laws problem in connection with Mormon polygamy. You got a very few cases involving Native Americans who had polygamous marriages. Some of their tribes did. And sometimes questions of legal rights would arise because of the children of polygamous marriages. And in those cases, the American courts really don't seem to have been particularly troubled by recognizing those marriages. Their attitude was, hey, you know, the Native Americans had a right to be here. These are their customs. We'll enforce their customs.
Yeah. Speaking of, you mentioned children there. You know, same-sex couples often have children. What's the situation there in terms of, you know, the issues that can arise in a family situation?
Well, there actually is one very live case that where litigation is still ongoing, and this is the Miller-Jenkins case in Virginia. So we've got a couple, their first names are Janet and Lisa. They formed a civil union in Vermont in 2000. Then Lisa gave birth to a daughter in 2002, and they moved to Vermont. And then the couple broke up, and Lisa, the biological mother of the child, moved back to where her family was in Virginia. But she wanted to end the relationship. She filed to dissolve her civil union in a Vermont court, and the Vermont court ordered visitation. And Lisa, the biological mother, didn't like that. She switched attorneys. She filed another suit in Virginia to declare herself the sole parent. And for a while, there were conflicting judgments in the two states over which one of them had the right to decide the case and what the result ought to be. That has been resolved for the time being because the intermediate Virginia court has decided that they don't have jurisdiction. There was already litigation going on in the Vermont court and under federal law. They said, you know, we can't take this up if another court is already taking it up. But the Virginia Supreme Court may hear this, and it may go a different way. Again, you get really strange results if you say we're not going to recognize same-sex marriages at all, because same-sex marriage, as in marriages generally, sometimes they create parental rights. In every state that recognizes these relationships now, if someone gives birth to a child as a consequence of artificial insemination or donor insemination, the spouse of the biological mother is deemed at law to be the parent of that child without needing to go through adoption. Again, it would be very strange if you had a parental relationship recognized in one state that isn't given any recognition in another state. It would mean that the child could be kidnapped by a stranger and taken into another state, and that other state wouldn't recognize the parental right. It would be very strange.
Florida is a state that has outlawed adoption of children by gay people.
Mm-hmm.
Is the story there, and is that going on in more than one state?
I'm not sure how that law would play into a conflict situation. Just as I read the Florida statute, I take it that the statute has so far only been construed to mean what adoption proceedings will be approved by the courts in Florida. I don't think that it means that if a gay couple have an adopted child, it's not safe to take that adopted child to Disney World because the Florida police will take your child away and say that we don't recognize your parenthood. There's no authority in Florida that says that they'd go that far, and I'd be very surprised if they did.
Have the courts been presented with claims that same-sex marriage is a legal right?
They have. There actually have been claims of that kind going back to the 1970s, and with a very few exceptions, they've always lost. The only state in which they unambiguously won was Massachusetts, where the Massachusetts Supreme Court said that there was an obligation under the state constitution to recognize same-sex marriages. And then there are a couple of other states that have, where the courts have held that you've got an obligation, if not to call it a marriage, at least to give the couple the same rights as married couples. You've got decisions like that in Vermont and in New Jersey.
Have people claimed that prohibiting same-sex marriages is to violate civil rights laws or violate sex discrimination laws?
It's hard to make a claim based on laws, because if a law is inconsistent with another law, well, they're both passed by the same legislature. The legislature doesn't have to have the same rules everywhere. The real question is, you know, does the prohibiting same-sex marriage, does it violate some provision of the state constitution, which is a limit on what the legislature can do? And that's what there's been litigation arguing that, again, going back to the 1970s, but it's almost always lost. I think that this is an area where, until recently, courts have been very reluctant to stick their necks out, particularly since the idea of same-sex marriage was so unpopular for such a long time.
Yeah. How did same-sex marriage come to be legal in Massachusetts? It might be useful to recall some relatively recent history here.
What immediately happened was that there was a lawsuit brought in Massachusetts by some same-sex couples who wanted to get married and who'd been refused marriage licenses, and they claimed that under the state constitution they had a right to the marriage licenses, and the court agreed with them. But what really brought the same-sex marriage issue into salience in the United States was much earlier, in 1993. It looked for a while like the Hawaii Supreme Court was going to mandate recognition of same-sex marriage there. And same-sex marriage only became an issue in American politics after this decision by the Hawaii Supreme Court that made it seem likely that that was what was going to happen. Now, it didn't happen in Hawaii because the court was overruled by a constitutional amendment before the litigation could finish and before the court could do what it had indicated it was likely to do and mandate recognition of same-sex marriage there. But it put the issue on the radar screen for all of the United States, and litigation went on in other states until 10 years later they prevailed in Massachusetts.
Is same-sex marriage in Massachusetts secure?
Well, what's most recently happened is that there was movement in the state legislature to put a referendum before the voters in Massachusetts to overrule the court. It appears now, because of a procedural maneuver, that that is not going to happen this year. They're going to try next year. In order to overrule the state Supreme Court, you've got to bring a constitutional amendment before the people of Massachusetts. And before you can do that, the amendment has to be approved in two successive sessions of the legislature. So it takes more than 2 years just to put the issue on the ballot. So it appears now that this may end up on the ballot in Massachusetts, but it doesn't seem likely to happen before 2010. And by that time, Massachusetts will have been living with same-sex marriage for a long time. It's not at all clear what the outcome of decision would be. Public opinion seems to be shifting in favor of same-sex marriage. That's what all of the polls are indicating. So it's in the interests of supporters of same-sex marriage to postpone this for as long as possible. Mm. The longer you wait, the more likely it is that they're going to win.
Yeah. Tell us something of the history of the same-sex marriage movement and how it is that we're seeing a shift in public opinion.
Well, I think the biggest reason why you've seen the shift is just the emergence of the gay liberation movement, really starting in the late 60s, early 1970s that meant that more and more gay people were willing to be open with other people about being gay. And people's attitudes toward gay people changes as they report knowing somebody who's gay. In 1985, only a quarter of Americans reported having a gay friend or a relative or a coworker. And the same survey in 2000 found that three-quarters of the population of the United States had a gay friend, relative, or coworker, and only a fifth reported not knowing anyone who was gay. And the number who said that they had a gay friend or close acquaintance went from 22% in 1985 to 56% by 2000. So gay people became increasingly visible, and the claims that they were making became the claims of familiar human beings, not distant abstractions. And people become aware of the hardships that come with having these relationships that don't get recognized.
Yeah.
The other two big things are the AIDS epidemic and the lesbian baby boom, because when people had AIDS, their partners weren't regarded as next of kin, so hospitals could refuse them the right to visitation. They couldn't make medical decisions. Surviving partners sometimes lost their homes. They lose property. And at the same time, more and more lesbian couples were having children. The last census finds that a third of lesbian couples are raising children.
Yeah.
And they worry about, well, what's going to happen if the biological mother dies and some relative contests the right of the surviving partner to continue to have a relationship with the child? What's going to happen if the couple separates? So horror stories have accumulated, and that's also increased the pressure for some legal recognition of these relationships.
Yeah. Also, it seems that there is a significant number of gay male couples who are raising children.
According to the last census, about a fifth of gay male couples are raising children.
Yeah.
So not as high as the lesbian couples, but significant numbers, yes.
Yeah, 22%. Also, something else that interesting that happened on Election Day, Arizona voted down a proposed amendment to ban same-sex marriage.
Yeah, it was the first time that a state constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage was defeated. Now, that was because the amendment was extremely broad. It prohibited any recognition of any relationship other than marriage, and so that was going to have bad effects for heterosexual couples. But it is no longer automatically the case that these amendments are going to get enacted wherever they get proposed. And you know, you can get misled by the numbers here. It's true, there are only five states, counting New Jersey, which is on the way to doing it, that recognize same-sex relationships and give them the rights of marriage. You've got Massachusetts, but you've got three other states that have laws that say that same-sex couples get all of the rights of married couples with a different label. California calls them domestic partnerships. Vermont and Connecticut call them civil unions, and there is a bill that looks extremely likely to be passed in the legislature of New Jersey saying that to the same effect. But that's only five states, but if you put them together, they're 18% of the population of the United States.
Hmm. And the High Court in New Jersey ruled, did it not, that the state constitution guarantees same-sex couples the legal benefits of marriage, but it didn't go all the way and say...
It didn't say that you had to give them the name. And for reasons that I think are not altogether well understood, the label matters an awful lot to people on both sides of the divide, that people who are opposed to same-sex marriage think that there's something very important about the label of marriage, that in some way the institution of marriage will be damaged if you use the label of marriage to refer to same-sex couples. And really, for the same reason, members of same-sex relationships feel that if you don't call them marriage, that's assigning them an inferior second-class status, and it's insulting, and they shouldn't have to put up with that.
Yeah, I wonder if any challenge has been brought against the civil union or domestic partnership laws by gay couples who see the
There's litigation ongoing.
Yeah.
I think that there's litigation going on in California. I think there may be litigation going on in Connecticut.
Do you see a point on the horizon when you think we can say it's by and large this issue has been settled?
Well, everything gets settled eventually. But you just look at interracial marriage. The United States was divided about interracial marriage, and now we've settled it. But it took us 300 years.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that eventually the same-sex marriage issue will get settled, but not in the immediate foreseeable future. And so I think that it makes sense for the time being to assume that we're not going to reach closure on this and to try to think about how we can live with this agreement.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Northwestern Law Professor Andrew Koppelman. He is the author most recently of Same-Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. The book is published by the Yale University Press. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon, the discussion with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers if you'd like to join us. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. What is the situation for citizens of other nations that recognize same-sex marriage? We mentioned Canada earlier, in same-sex marriages who come to the U.S.
Right now, there is no law on it. No court has yet been presented with that issue, with the exception of what is, for reason I said earlier, the easy case of, I think there was one case in which a lesbian couple in Florida traveled to Canada, got married, came right back to Florida, and there filed a suit in federal court saying that you've got to recognize our marriage. And that was rejected by the federal court saying, you can't get out of the restrictions of local law that easily. And I think that's got to make sense. But the harder case is what happens if a couple from Canada who live in Canada, Canadian tourists, come mm-hmm. to Disney World in Orlando, and for whatever reason, again, one of them gets hospitalized. And the hospital wants to know who can make medical decisions for this person. And you've got to make some decision about, do you recognize that relationship? And I think that it presents all of the same issues.
Yeah. Would you talk with us about a case or two that you are watching that you find interesting and you think that could be very, very important?
Well, I think that the most important current case that is still ongoing is the Miller-Jenkins case that I was talking about before, where you've got a dispute within a lesbian couple over which state's laws apply to a parent-child relationship, where that parent-child relationship is recognized in one state and not in another state. And there's serious arguments have been made by judges in the state of Virginia that, well, you know, we just don't recognize any right arising out of that relationship in this state. And if the Virginia Supreme Court holds the same thing, then you're going to have a situation where parent-child relationships for thousands of couples are going to be insecure unless the U.S. Supreme Court steps in and straightens it out.
Hmm. Any cases before the Supreme Court at the moment involving
No.
any of these issues?
No, none of these issues are before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. Bottom line here, when and when not should same-sex marriages be recognized by states that do not allow them?
The bottom line is that states should get to recognize the relationships of their own citizens. So I think when people are traveling around the country, but there's no question about where they live, those marriages should be valid for all purposes. If you are just passing through a state, that state that you're passing through has no legitimate interest at all in denying recognition to your relationship. You're not trying to settle there. You're not trying to stay there. You're not trying to impose anything on them. You're just passing through the state, which you've got a constitutional right to do. if you live in a state that doesn't allow same-sex marriage and you're just trying to play a trick to get out from under the law by traveling to Canada for a day and traveling to Massachusetts for a day and coming right back again, then you should lose. You should not have your relationship recognized. The hardest case is the one that you started the program with, where a couple lives in Massachusetts and then they move to Illinois. Just permanently relocate to Illinois. And then if you recognize their marriages for all purposes, I think same-sex couples in Illinois could reasonably say, wait a second, we don't get our relationship recognized here, but these people, and we've lived here for 20 years, but these people who just came here get their relationship recognized. What I suggest in the book is that you should try to think about the difference between marriages that can only be created, rights of marriage that can only be created by law, like the right to an income tax exemption, and the rights of a marriage that could have been created by contract, like a medical power of attorney or a right to inherit. And if it's something that you could have done by contract anyway, then you don't make this couple who just moved here create a whole new set of legal papers. If they created this right under Massachusetts law, then, and that's an ongoing right under Massachusetts law, then that's how you should treat it in Illinois. So if the couple who moved to Illinois, one of them dies without a will, well, the fact that they're married should be enough to let the other one inherit the property, for example.
Yeah. What is the situation with this couple that we've talked about who marry in Massachusetts? They intend to remain in Massachusetts, but they move. For whatever reason, they relocate. Is that couple they move to Illinois, are they going to be recognized?
Well, as I just said, they should.
They should,
what makes
but
the most sense, again, just following the precedence, is you can unbundle marriage into a whole bunch of rights. Marriage as a legal status really just does consist of a bunch of different rights. Marriage is the right to inherit without a will, and marriage is the right to tax exemption, and so on and so forth. And what I suggest in the book is, because there's no law on this, and actually this was never even squarely confronted in the interracial marriage cases, that the way you should think about this is this a right that they could have created if they'd used just a different kind of legal instrument in the state that they're from? And if they could have done that, then they could have done a will, but instead they got married. Well, when it becomes relevant in Illinois, you just should treat it as if it were a will. Because Illinois certainly has no interest in the forms by which rights get created in Massachusetts. If in Massachusetts there's a rule that says that a will has to be signed by two witnesses, and in Illinois you're required to have three witnesses. Well, if it was valid when you made it out in Illinois, if it was valid when you made it out in Massachusetts, Illinois is not going to refuse to honor it just because you didn't follow the same forms. We don't care about forms.
Yeah. Very interesting. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Professor Koppelman, thank you for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Andrew Koppelman has been my guest in this portion of the program. He is a professor of law at Northwestern University, and he is the author of Same-Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. In this book, Professor Koppelman doesn't make an argument for or against same-sex marriage, and he acknowledges the issue of same-sex marriage divides us, but he says there are existing rules that can help us find our way across a thorny landscape. The book, Same-Sex, Different States, published by the Yale University Press.